Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. A few days ago, we did our monthly show with the Los Angeles Times book critic and the best read woman on the internet, in my view, or probably the best read woman in the world. Bethann Patrick, delightful lady. Every month she comes on the show to recommend new books. She had seven for April, including new books by very well-known writers like Salman Rushdie, Eric Larson, Amor Towles. And she had another suggestion too. I'm going to show you a short clip and then we're going to get into it. The Earth, an ecological and racial history of secularization by an author called Mohamed Amer Meziane. It's published by Verso. So politically, I'm guessing it's a leftist or certainly a progressive book. What's the argument in the States of the Earth?
Well, the argument from Meziane is that he sort of places the blame, if you will, for statehood and the way we look at nation states and therefore imperialism. He places the blame on Western Christendom and its imperial attempts. He talks a lot about the Crusades in the early part of this book.
Well, if Bethann, who is my guide to all book things, recommends it, we needed to get a certain Mohammed Amer Meziane on the show, and we got him, The States of the Earth. Mohammed, welcome. Congratulations on the new book. It came out a few years ago in France. It's already got some awards for translation. Is Bethann right? Are you apportioning blame in this book, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, I would say it's a bit more complicated than that, because I'm trying to think of what, you know, sometimes is called the Anthropocene or the climate crisis as really, you know, different processes that come together and create an effect that nobody's, you know, intentionally producing. I don't think that there is one single force, in fact, in history that has the power to actually create an effect by virtue of one's own intention. And, you know, there needs to be the power to, you know, act according to one's intention, to be held responsible. So what I call the secular or the secularocene is really how different strata of history come together and form what we call the climate crisis.
The subtitle of the book, The States of the Earth, is suggestive: an ecological and racial history of secularization. Tell me more about that. Those are three powerful words: ecological, racial, and secularization. How are they all bound up together in your view?
Well, let me maybe begin with secularization, because it's not really a very common word. I started sort of working on secularization because when I was in Europe, particularly, I was struck by the fact that many politicians, especially after 9/11, so to speak, actually had a certain idea of what the West was and what the West had become and why it had become what it had become. By which I mean that I remember that many politicians were saying, well, we can't, you know, bring all these immigrants in Europe, because they can't really become real European citizens, because, in fact, the blame is to put on the fact that they're not able to separate politics from religion. This is what these politicians used to say, especially in France, but it was the case in Western Europe more generally. So actually, the discourse was not, if you will, straightforward exclusion. It was exclusion via a certain idea, a certain divide of the world, according to which the West would have separated religion from politics, and on the other hand, the Orient, and in fact, more specifically, migrants from Africa and Asia would be incapable of separating politics from religion. Of course, mostly due to Islam, according to these politicians, most of them being conservative. So what I thought was that secularization, from my point of view, is a narrative. It's to some extent a myth, because it's what these politicians assume about the West as a sort of norm, in fact, to which other people should conform. And in fact, the problem also is that even when these people who come from other places than the West come to the West, even though they, you know, are good citizens and conform to and obey the laws and so on and so forth, this discourse produces a sort of suspicion that in the end, they might be a threat because they're not able to separate politics from religion. So secularization is something I focused on because I realized also historically that what we call Orientalism and certain forms of racial exclusions against people who are defined as Arabs or Muslims in Africa and Asia, not just in the Arab world, that historically speaking, Orientalism had defined them by precisely saying that they were not able to separate politics from religion. So secularization is a layer, if you will, of what has sometimes been called Orientalism. Now, on the other hand, of course, there is this ecological layer.
But before we get to the ecological side, are you arguing then that it's incorrect to separate secularization from faith, and that secularization and the process of secularization is a form of religion? That argument has been made in one way or the other many times. It's in some ways a kind of critique of the Enlightenment.
Well, I would say two things that are a bit different from this notion that the modern world is really a sort of new religion. I would say two things. The first thing is that religion is not really a universal word because it's a very European word. So to some extent, what happened is that the West projected religions onto other people by saying this is religion or this is not religion, right? If you take the case of France, France has the power to say this headscarf or hijab is a religious sign, but this is in fact a decision, right? So we see that saying what's religion or not is not an easy business. So that's the first thing. And the second thing, which might be in fact even more important, is that I define secularization as the attempt to bring heaven on earth, right? So the claim that, so to speak, capitalist development and what we call growth, that so to speak, something such as heaven would be realizable and achievable on earth.
You teach at Brown University in Providence. You said you're a nomad before we went live, but you lived part of your life in Providence. I'm assuming that in terms of this coming together of secularism or certainly progress and bringing heaven on earth, the United States is Exhibit A in your argument, is it?
What do you mean by Exhibit A?
Well, it's a good case study for making your argument.
Yeah, I suppose. In fact, in the book, the book is much more focused on 19th century and on the three, main powers, at least at that time, of Western Europe, that is to say France, Britain, and Germany. But yeah, I suppose that because of what I call imperiality, which is connected to colonialism, but in my view is also more profoundly maybe or more centrally a way of representing sovereign power or the sovereignty of the state, then yeah, to some extent you could say
how
that
would it more. Work though in terms of the settling of the United States, which some people of course argue is a classic colonial endeavor in terms of the native peoples here and so on and so forth. Given that America was founded not, certainly the the northern bit, the New England bit, the Providence, Rhode Island bit, was founded by, settled, colonized, if you want, by what some people today might think of as religious fundamentalists, who certainly had a very strong conception, not just of building heaven on earth, but building a religious heaven on earth. How does this fit in to your argument?
Well, as your colleague said, I go back to the Crusades, and therefore I do think that there are, you know, so to speak, Christian dimensions in modernity and specifically in secularizing processes. However, I always sort of stress the Roman and therefore imperial dimensions of what is sometimes, I think, too rapidly just called Christianity in general, right? So I would first argue that it's a very specific Christianity that was deployed in America, but also as the United States of America, in which the Christian dimension of it coexists with this imperial dimension of it, which really comes from, you know, Roman, in fact, pre-Christian sources. And you can say that this process begins with Constantine, so, you know, a long time ago. And I don't think that anything in the, so to speak, the religion of Christ had necessarily to pave the way to the conversion of a Roman emperor to Christianity. So that's the first thing I'm trying to make sense of. But I think, you know, and I think in this country, this is what people refer to sometimes as manifest destiny. I call imperiality the desire and the claim, to some extent the pretension, you could say, the pretense of representing God on earth. And I'm just making the point that most of the time when people have done this, or have at least had the power to do this significantly and in ways that led to the construction of nation states, when they did this, it's because they were both claiming to be representative of God on earth, because, and to the extent that they were also emperors. And I think that, yes, the United States is an extension of Europe, so to speak, also because it embodies this tradition, which, in fact, you can see happening by the very fact that the United States is a federation or a federal government. And as it's the case in Germany, many of the symbols, such as the eagle, for example, come, in fact, from very old imperial Christian representations that really, you know, were very common during the Middle Ages. So this, I think there is a deep history, if you will, of how politics and religion work together in the West, which has to do with the form and the imaginary of being an empire, so to speak.
As I said in the introduction, you teach at Brown University. You describe yourself as a philosopher, or certainly the blurb for the book, as a philosopher, a performer, and a professor. Tell me a little bit, Mohammed, about yourself. How did you, you weren't born in the US. How did you get to Brown? And what do you mean when you describe yourself, or when you're described as a performer?
Right. Well, the first thing, I mean, maybe I should just describe where I was born and this story very shortly. I was actually born in London. My parents are from Algeria, so North Africa, one of the countries in North Africa. And in fact, we left the UK when I was 6 months, and because I decided to go to Kuwait. So I spent my early childhood there. And basically what happened is that we were in Algeria during the summer of year 1990. And, you know, it was the Gulf War. And then, you know, basically we lost everything there because we couldn't go back to Kuwait. So we stayed in Algeria, which was a very troubled time by then. And eventually my parents decided, because of a civil war that was going to explode in Algeria, to in fact immigrate to migrate to France. which is where I was trained, was this is where I, you know, got my degree and PhD in philosophy. But before I became a philosopher, I was actually a musician, and I was, you know, basically interested in doing this rather than reading and certainly not writing books. And then all of a sudden, just you know, philosophy became something that a language that I needed to make sense also of this history of displacement. And to some extent, this book is also a way of you know, trying to understand our own trajectory and my own trajectory in the context of much broader collective temporalities.
So how long have you been in the US?
I've been in the US since 2018 when I was hired by Columbia. Yeah.
You having fun? You enjoying yourself?
Yes. Yeah. You know, I also go back to Europe. I also give talks in North Africa and other places as well in the what is called the Global South. So I travel. For me, this is a place where I found a form of academic freedom that is a bit more difficult to find elsewhere. Yeah.
Suits your nomadic lifestyle. We're speaking with Mohamed Amer Mezian, the author of The States of the Earth, a strongly recommended book by my friend Beth-Ann Patrick. Had to get Mohamed on the show. Beth-Ann's also a great fan of Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics. A lot of people are getting turned onto it. It's a great publication. Going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Mohamed to talk about the ecological aspect, the earth aspect of his argument. So don't go away, anyone. We'll be back in a minute with Mohamed Amer Mezian.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought, a quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We are speaking with Mohamed Amer Mezian, the author of The States of the Earth. It came out in France a few years ago. Now it's out in the US. It's getting some interesting reviews. Beth-Ann Patrick, our resident book critic, included in one of her seven notable books for April. Mohamed, we talked a little bit earlier about religion and colonialism. What about the ecological element? That seems to be the heart of the book. What are you arguing here?
I discovered, you know, by looking at different archives and historical documents, I discovered that, in fact, in many places, indigenous people were thinking that the mines were haunted by spirits or demons. There was specifically an example I found where a colonial administrator a governor in Indochina, in fact, during the late 19th century, says that actually indigenous people, and complains about them, that actually they're seeing the underground as being hunted by a dragon. And in fact, they see the mine as being the body of a dragon. So what I think it shows is that secularization is one of the conditions under which capitalism can emerge, but also the condition under which extractivism can emerge. This means, I mean, for at least two reasons. The first one is that, if you will, to delve in the entrails of the earth, you need not only to change the conception of the earth, but the conception of the subsoil. So there is a disenchantment and also disenchantment of the underground world. And it's interesting to see also that in many different religious traditions, the underground world is in fact identified to hell, right? So I'm just trying to say that one needs to destroy, reform, or change these forms of life if one wants to deploy extractivism as such.
It's an interesting argument, Mohammed. You talk about extractivism and secularization. You also noted that you spent part of your childhood growing up in Kuwait. But aren't the most extractive economies in the world, in the Gulf, aren't they also often, in the Saudi case in particular, aren't they strongly religious? They're anything but secular.
Well, I don't think they're anything but secular, precisely because I don't see secularization as something necessarily opposed to religion. I see secularization as the transformation of religious traditions that stem from the introduction and the globalization of both the nation state and capitalism, right? So it means that certain, sometimes even most politicized or extreme religious forms are not something that have no connection to capitalism. So that's the first point. But more specifically, you know that in fact, it's the case with Saudi Arabia, but also other countries in the global south. They apply a principle which comes from mining law, basically, in fact, comes from French mining law, according to which the state owns the resources that are underground in the subsoils, right? So it means that if someone finds, for example, a coal or oil supply, it doesn't mean to say that because he found it, this belongs to him. It belongs to the state because there is this new principle that emerges with the French Revolution. And in fact, that is institutionalized by Napoleon, in fact, that, if you will, determines this principle, by which you can see that even states that claim to be religious are never fully religious, precisely because many of the modern institutions that have been globalized, even in the global south, come, if you will, from secular institutions. In the case of Islam specifically, it's well known by experts that the very model of the civil code, which was implemented by Napoleon, which was a secular, in fact, you could say the first secular law in history, actually the form of the code serves as a model of what will if you will, Islamic law is going to become since, in fact, the 19th century onwards. So, in fact, it might sound counterintuitive, but because precisely religion is a very vague category, what we have in our modern world and globalized world is never either a purely religious phenomenon or a purely secular phenomenon. We only have hybrids, so to speak.
Interesting, Mohammed. This is a controversial book. I think most people are going to be intrigued by it. The States of the Earth, an Ecological and Racial History of Secularization. We've talked about secularization. We've talked a little bit about ecology. What about the racial history? How does this fit in to your narrative?
Well, It fits in the narrative because I'm looking at the history of the histories of empires. I'm actually looking at states, and I'm saying that states, in the form that they took in Europe since, say, the 14th and 15th century onwards, so what we call the modern state or the nation state, I'm trying to rewrite the history of this. Right? This is why it's called the States of the Earth, which means, of course, these sovereign states and the fact that they have an ecological impact, right? Because they determine the physical state, so to speak, in which the Earth is or find itself. So the racial dimension comes from the fact that, of course, these states racialize populations, right? If one goes back to 1492, right, which is for many scholars, in fact, the beginning of what they call modernity, which coincides with the conquest of the Americas, if you take these events and you take, in fact, a global history into account, then you can see that these states actually construct themselves via the racialization of other populations, right? And of course, you know, if one is to analyze globalization in an honest way, one sees, of course, that the hierarchy between the global north and the global south is, of course, stem from a global history of racism. But more specifically, if you will, I think that what we call modernity or disenchantment is something that presupposes race as one of its matrices. I go back to the laws of the purity of blood in Spain, 15th century Spain, because precisely it shows that Christianity started transforming itself because it changed the way in which it conceived of conversion, precisely because Jewish and Muslim populations who were there, who were living in what was then called Al-Andalus, when they were conquered by the Crusaders, in fact, because they were in their minds Crusaders, but they are, you know, Spanish armies. What happened is that they said they are not fully converted. That is to say, they're Christians, but they're not. We shouldn't think of them as having pure blood or being exactly the equals of Christians, because they might be, you know, falsely converted or things like that, which is what they called impure blood, which is, in my view, one of the matrices of race. So my point, if you will, is that without taking into account this global history, without also taking into account the very long history of how the West interacted with non-Western worlds, especially in what nowadays we call the Middle East and North Africa, that without, in fact, understanding the West in, if you will, this ecosystem, one doesn't really understand the West itself, right? You can't write a purely Eurocentric history of how modernity emerged, because if you do so, then it means that, you know, by virtue of magic, Christianity becomes capitalism. But nothing happened that way. It happened because precisely what is now called the West interacted in different ways via colonialism, but not only colonialism.
Yeah, it's interesting. The book is published by Verso. Verso has a strong tradition in radical books, many of them derived from theories of Marx. My sense of what you're arguing, Mohammed, is that your focus on disenchantment makes a parallel theory of modernity, the Weberian and Nietzschean interest in disenchantment. Is that where your thinking is coming from, in that tradition, rather than the Marxist tradition of class struggle?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, it doesn't come from Weber.
Although Weber wrote about it extensively, and I'm guessing in a sense, yeah, you would agree with his theories about the Protestant ethic and the origins of capitalism.
Right. Well, yes and no, let's put it that way. Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I do think that, if you will, these religious, spiritual dimensions of modernity are very important, and that without a theory of that, you can't really understand not only capitalism, but more importantly, the birth of capitalism. That is to say, how does capitalism emerge, right? And where I'm, to some extent, more Marxist than Weber, is that I maintain that it's mainly state violence that make capitalism.
Although Weber was also a great theorist, of course, of the state. He developed theories of the state much more extensively than Marx. Absolutely. It's interesting. A lot to discuss. Sorry, I'll let you finish. You had another point.
Yeah, the second point is that, in my view, one of the criticism I would have of Weber, or at least the difference I would emphasize, is that I think Weber, and he's indebted to Hegel on that, I think, has this vision that Christianity or in this case, more specifically, Protestantism, by virtue of its theological configuration, had to some extent the power of engendering modernity. And I'm not saying that there are religious origins to modernity, so to speak. I'm saying that there would have been no disenchantment if there was no colonialism. And I don't think that this is something that Weber said. That is to say,
interesting. Yeah, that's a provocation. That's a grenade, Mohammed. Maybe you're right. No, so say that again.
Christianity there would be no disenchantment if there was no colonialism, because it's the circulations between the colonies and the metropoles, and what actually also Europeans, including missionaries, experienced in non-Western worlds, that created a dynamic of disenchantment, not the essence of Christianity.
There's so much there, and we're not going to get into this, but I'd be really interested, maybe there's a book in it almost, about distinguishing forms of Christian colonialism from Islamic colonialism, because of course Islam was born in war and its own forms of colonialism. But that is that's a subject for another conversation, Mohammed, maybe another book. I'm going to end with Bethan. Bethan has a kind of, she didn't know I was going to talk to you, but she has a point that she wanted to make to you. So I'm going to play it and then maybe you can respond to her, because her questions are always better than mine. So here we go with Bethan's question to Mohammed Amer Mezian.
He's saying, what if the Earth states are actually responsible for the state of the Earth? And that is a huge simplification, Andrew, but it is a very interesting thing to look at and think about as we deal with climate change. You know, have we exported from the West this feeling that everyone has to be a state with defenses and with dependence on fossil fuels? And he's really interrogating the idea of secularization, because he actually thinks that secular governments are a good thing, but that what we consider secular in the West is actually a promotion of capitalism. It's not real secularism. He thinks that we should have kept, you know, an idea of God or gods, you know, in our, that we shouldn't have separation of church and state completely. But I'm not sure if he fully agrees with me that a sense of spirituality doesn't have to have a great deal to do with faith. He has a long section in his last chapter before his epilogue. He has a section on the word religion and how that's a Western word, a word derived from Western languages and used for Western purposes. But I want to say, Dr. Meziane, he's just really well known as a very young maverick philosopher, okay? I want to say, what about the idea of spirituality and a sense of wonder and how those things need to be encouraged in humans in order to have the kind of governments that we need in this world that is changing so rapidly? Yeah.
So there you have it, Mohammed. Bethan put it beautifully. In a world of disenchantment, can we still have faith?
Well, that's a great question. I suppose you can, but I'm just going to start from somewhere else, which is that if I'm making one point about that, it's the following one. I'm saying that because we wanted to realize heaven on earth, we have destroyed the earth, right? And that the earth didn't ask, so to speak, to bear this burden of heaven, right? And by making this argument, I'm not trying to say I defend religion against secularism or the other way around, right? I'm trying to say even people who claim that they do not have faith, right, religious faith, one of the reasons why they are, as you and me are, in this civilization, right, it's because we have invested this world as a site for our own salvation. Nobody really abandoned salvation. Some people said, we're going to find salvation in this world now, right? Not just individually, but by virtue of infinite growth, which we know is impossible since the resources of the earth are finite, right? So of course, so this is why disenchantment is the word I use as a reference to Weber, also in by, you know, to criticize him as well. I mean, at least some of his arguments. But I think that disenchantment doesn't go without a certain kind of enchantment. It depends what you enchant or not. And in fact, yes, I think that infinite growth is a dream that has been enchanted, in fact, and that we see that it's not possible anymore. Hence the fact that the ecological crisis has spiritual effects and spiritual consequences. And this is also why also people turn to, you know, other forms of spiritualities that sometimes are called New Age or sometimes animist and so on and so forth. So my point, if you will, is that I criticize both secular state and religious states. Okay, I'm not saying that secular states are bad, but religious states are good. The reason why I criticize the states of the earth is because I think that secularization has precisely transformed religions themselves, right? State religions today are part of, if you will, this extractivist globalized system that you could call of course, capitalism. But as far as this question of heaven on and earth and heaven on earth is concerned, I think we should think about what it means not to, in fact, invest this world as we do, right? That is to say, not make earth bear the burden of our dreams of heaven. And you can go both ways. That is to say, you can say this is true atheism to some extent, because we're not going to seek salvation again, or this is also in the meantime true spirituality, because you're looking for salvation in another world, not in this world, right? So I'm not trying to say that faith is the solution. I'm trying to say that if you will, a certain relationship to what I call in my second book the metaphysical dimensions of reality is something that is needed. But this is not only religious, in my view.
So in other words, what you're saying is if we could have asked the Earth if they wanted to participate, or if they asked the Earth if it wanted to participate in our heaven on Earth project, it would have said no, Mohammed, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I think it says no in its own language.